with cirrhosi hepatica, cirrhosis of the liver. The doctor had ordered him to stop drinking, and from that day she had refused to bring him another bottle. Unfortunately, the result had been that he went out drinking at night.
Papa, I have your coffee.
Elisabetta patted his arm.
Eh?
Her father stirred, and his eyelids fluttered open. His bloodshot gaze found her face, but it was unfocused.
She was beautiful. The way she looked, her eyes, the perfect blue.
Papa, wake up.
Elisabetta thought he could be sleeping with his eyes open, as if in a waking dream.
She was innocent and yet wise, graceful and beautiful. He loved women, the most beautiful women.
What are you talking about?
Elisabetta began to worry in earnest. Her father was looking at her, but he wasn't seeing her. He never acted this way, even when he woke up drunk.
Look at her, they're blue. Knowing yet innocent. In the blue, it's the color of truth itself.
Papa, wake up.
Elisabetta jostled him gently.
Only Raphael could do it. And the Madonna of the Meadow, masterful. The Sfumato, a perfect example.
Elisabetta realized he was talking about the painter Raphael and sfumato, the technique of blurring the shadows in a painting. It was one of his favorite subjects, but she didn't know why he was talking about it now. She felt a bolt of alarm that something was seriously wrong. And just as she had that thought, her father's eyes rolled back in his head, and his head dropped to the side.
Papa!
Elisabetta shook him, frantic.
Wake up! Wake up!
I'm fine,
he mumbled, his eyelids fluttering again.
Should I get Dr. Pastore?
No.
Her father waved her off feebly, but didn't come to full alertness. He had never looked so ill, his pallor having gone from yellow to gray, and Elisabetta made a decision.
Papa, I'm going to get the doctor. I'll be right back.
Elisabetta sprang to her feet and hurried from the room. She didn't want to take any chances, and the doctor's office was only a few blocks away. She flew out of the apartment door, frantic. She ran down the street as fast as she could, her heart in her throat. Men moved out of her way, women gave her a wide berth, and children clung to their mother's skirts. Elisabetta realized she looked crazy, but she didn't care. She kept running, and her breath came ragged. The doctor's office was in a small brick house ahead, with pink geraniums in the window boxes. A bicycle veered into her path, but she jumped to the side, hurried to the doctor's, and flung open his door. Two men in the waiting room looked up from their newspapers, startled. The receptionist at the desk frowned.
What are you? Where's Dr. Pastore?
Elisabetta hustled to her desk.
My father needs help.
Sorry, Dr. Pastore is with a patient.
I can't wait.
Elisabetta ran past her to the examining room at the end of the hall, where she threw open the door to find short, bald, and bespectacled Dr. Pastore with an older man who sat on the examining table in his clothes.
Elisabetta!
Dr. Pastore recoiled, disconcerted.
Dr. Pastore, you have to come.
What do you think you're doing?
My father woke up and he's not making any sense. You need to come right away.
No, you must leave this instant.
Dr. Pastore threw up his hands.
Can't you see I'm with someone? You shouldn't be in here.
But there's something really wrong. I can tell. Please, he can't wait.
Elisabetta grabbed Dr. Pastore's arm, but he wrenched it from her grasp, and his patient shifted away from her on the table.
Yes, he can. Control yourself. His disease progresses slowly. He'll have spells now and then, as ammonia may be building up in his body, altering his mental status as a result of the decompensated cirrhosis. It's nothing to become alarmed about. Now please leave.
You have to come with me. It's an emergency.
No, it's not.
Yes, it is.
Go home and I'll be there at lunchtime. You saw I have patients waiting.
No, now.
Elisabetta could feel a nurse materialize behind her. Dr. Pastore sighed heavily.
Okay, as soon as I'm finished with this patient, I will come. That's the best I can do. Now, leave or I'll have you thrown out.
Thank you, but hurry.
Elisabetta turned around and flew past the disapproving nurse, then raced from the office and out of the doctor's house. She took a right when she hit the cobblestone street and ran home as fast as she could, pushing open the front door.
Papa!
Elisabetta bolted through the kitchen and back to the living room, where her father lay on the couch, shifting onto his side.
Papa, the doctor will be here very soon. I want him to look at you.
I'm fine, Elisabetta.
Her father opened his eyes, but to her surprise, they were wet with tears.
Papa, are you in pain?
No, no.
What is it? Why are you crying?
My darling daughter, my little one, I love you.
I love you too.
Elisabetta could see that his gaze was connecting with her, though his pallor was still strangely gray. She gestured at his coffee, which sat cooling.
Do you want your coffee or something to eat?
No, I don't feel very well.
Her father closed his eyes, and Elisabetta embraced him, holding him close, as if keeping him with her, instinctively acting on an unspoken terror of the worst.
The doctor will be here right away. You'll be all right.
Elisabetta, I am so sorry for being such a terrible father. You know that, don't you?
Elisabetta's throat caught with emotion.
Don't say that. You're a wonderful father.
No, I'm not, and I need you to forgive me. Tell me that you do.
What do you mean?
Elisabetta asked, stricken.
Why do you need to hear such a thing?
I do, and please tell me you forgive me, my darling. I feel so sick, and I want to go. I need to go, and I need to hear you forgive me. Do you?
Elisabetta felt tears spring to her eyes, at a moment that she couldn't acknowledge even to herself, in which her father seemed to be asking her permission to leave this earth.
Papa, I can't answer you.
I don't want you to go. Betta, please tell me you forgive me, and let me go.
Her father touched her arm, and Elisabetta began to cry, realizing the awful choice he was giving her, and knowing that there was only one answer, even though it was the last thing in the world she wanted, for her father was all she had left.
Papa, if there is anything to forgive, I forgive you.
His expression changed instantaneously. The frown in his forehead vanished, and his lips curved into a smile that she hadn't seen in years. His eyelids fluttered, and his eyes opened and met her gaze directly, full of a love that she could feel to her very marrow.
Papa, don't leave me alone.
Her father's serene gaze met her terrified one, and the light in him faded away until all she saw in his dark irises was her own heartbroken reflection. And she knew that she had released him, even though she couldn't bear that he was gone.
Papa!
Elisabetta shook him, trying to wake him up, but nothing happened. He lay with his head to the side, his neck drooping as if it were stretched. Every muscle in his face slackened and his mouth hung open, his jaw unhinged. His left arm flopped over the side of the couch. Elisabetta burst into anguished tears and sobs racked her body. She held him close and felt his soul departing his body, ascending into heaven where he belonged, there to live in a heaven of Raphael blue. Chapter 31. Elisabetta, August 1938. The afternoon sun beat down, dry and oppressive, and Elisabetta wilted at her father's graveside while the local priest conducted the service. Verano Cemetery was almost 19 centuries old, one of the world's most beautiful cemeteries, a suitably artistic setting for him to be laid to rest. Next to his grave was a carved marble statue of an angel in repose, on the headstone of a certain Di Giulio family. She sensed he would have liked that. His own headstone was small and of gray marble, as she hadn't been able to afford more. The ornate family mausoleums were in another section, but her father was being buried among humbler graves, some of which had large curved headstones bearing enameled portraits of the deceased. In his heyday, her father would have painted far better portraits. Her head hung and the black dress fit her poorly, as it was one her mother had left behind. She had been hoping all morning that her mother would magically appear at the church or at the cemetery, having read the notice of her father's death in the newspaper. But that did not happen, and Elisabetta felt silly for holding out such a vain hope. She had cried all the tears she could cry, having regained her emotional footing since her father's death, busying herself with sending out notices, ordering flowers, and arranging for the mass with the priest and for the burial with the undertaker. She had used her savings to bury her father, but that hadn't been enough. So the fund for the indigent had contributed, and the undertaker had extended her a partial credit, which had been kind. Marco stood on her right and Sandro on her left, and she felt touched that both of them had come. Marco had taken the time off from work, somber in his black uniform, and Sandro was in his dark jacket and pants, going in late to La Sapienza. Nonna stood behind them with her son Paolo and his wife Sofia, and the only other mourners were a few slovenly drinking buddies of her father's. She couldn't help but harbor resentment at them for encouraging his drinking, working against her efforts even after his diagnosis. The priest finished the prayer, everyone blessed themselves, and Elisabetta realized that the time had come to say her final goodbye to her father. Tears blurred her vision, though she maintained her composure and told him how much she loved him and always would. God be with you, the priest said, walking to her as he closed his breviary, and Elisabetta thanked him, grateful that he had agreed to officiate, though they rarely went to mass.
Nonna, thank you for coming.
Elisabetta embraced her, moved to feel Nonna hug her fiercely in return, her grip surprisingly strong, and when Elisabetta pulled away, Nonna's eyes were glistening.
You have my sympathy.
Nonna wiped wetness from underneath her glasses with her handkerchief.
And thank you, Paolo and Sofia, too.
Paolo nodded.
Please feel free to take a few days off.
No, I'm fine. I can come in tomorrow.
Elisabetta needed the money, but she didn't want to say so in front of everyone.
Fine, then.
Nonna flattened her lips, and Elisabetta knew that she understood. After Nonna and the Servanos left, Elisabetta crossed to her father's drinking buddies and thanked them for coming, out of respect to her father.
Elisabetta, we're so sorry.
Marco took her arm.
Yes, we are.
Sandro took her other arm.
Thank you both,
Elisabetta said uncomfortably. They were being nice, but competing to console her, which made her feel guilty.
I'll be fine. Don't you have to get to work?
Marco squeezed her arm gently.
Sadly, I do.
Sandro answered,
I don't, not yet.
Marco glanced at Sandro.
Take care of her, will you? She shouldn't be alone.
Yes, of course.
Sandro nodded, and Marco kissed Elisabetta on the cheek, then left. Elisabetta sat with Sandro on a bench at the cemetery under the shade of an umbrella pine. Headstones, monuments, and mausoleums surrounded them. Packed tight in rows among white oleander bushes, cypresses, and palm trees. The walkways between the graves were of yellow pebbles, and here and there a small green lizard darted into the sun, then escaped under a bush. Her tears were finally spent, and she felt numb with grief. Sandro remained companionably silent. Her father's grave was a few rows away, and she couldn't bring herself to leave him just yet. She didn't know how to separate from him. Was she supposed to just walk away? Elisabetta wiped her face with her handkerchief.
Sorry to make you wait, Sandro. You can go if you need to.
No, I'm fine.
He wasn't a perfect father. I know that.
Few are.
Yours is, Elisabetta blurted out. He's a lawyer, an important man. Everyone looks up to him.
That's true. I'm lucky in him. But he's not perfect.
Sandro paused.
What will you do now, on your own? Can I help you? Anything you need?
No, I have it figured out. I'll move, as rent makes up the most of my monthly expenses, and I only need one bedroom.
You'll stay in Trastevere, of course.
Yes. I've been looking around, but so far none of the landlords will allow Rico.
You can't leave him behind. He's your boy.
That he is.
Maybe someday I'll be your boy, eh? I'll settle for second place, but not third.
Sandro smiled, and Elisabetta knew he meant Marco, but she felt awkward again and wanted to change the subject.
Sandro, why do you say that about your father? That he's not perfect? He's your hero, isn't he?
My hero?
Sandro pursed his lips, thinking it over.
No, not really. I love and I admire him, but I can't say he's my hero. I do have one, though.
The professor, then? Levi Civita?
No, not him either.
Then who?
You, Elisabetta. You are my hero.
Me? I'm a waitress.
Elisabetta looked up to see if he was kidding, but his expression was sincere.
You don't see yourself as special, but you are. You do what needs to be done, no matter what.
You kept doing after your mother left, and you will keep doing after your father.
I don't know anyone who does that but you.
Only you.
Elisabetta felt her mouth go dry, not knowing what to say. But she couldn't deny the power of his words, or that they made her feel stronger, even on the worst day of her life. Chapter 32. Elisabetta, August 1938. That night, Elisabetta sat at the kitchen table watching Rico eat, still in her black dress from the funeral. The cat's throaty chewing was the only sound in the empty apartment, and she felt her father's absence, for he had been good company even if he wasn't sober. She had no one to take care of now except Rico. Someone knocked, the sound startling her. She rose, crossed the kitchen, and opened the door, surprised to find Marco there, smiling at her in uniform.
Marco.
Elisabetta, come with me.
What? Where?
Come on, let's go.
Marco took her hand and led her from the apartment, then to the street, which was almost blocked by an elegant black convertible coupe with a gleaming chrome grille, curved sections over each wheel that came to a dramatic point, and more flashy chrome on the sides.
You know this car?
Elisabetta asked, astonished.
Yes, it belongs to my boss.
Marco strode to the passenger side door, opening it for her with a flourish.
Isn't it beautiful? It's a Lancia Astura, designed by Pininfarina. Get in. I'll take you for a ride.
You drive?
They taught me. It's easy.
But you have to be 21. You have to have a license. It's against the law.
Elisabetta, we are the law. Now please, get in.
Marco gestured at the open passenger door, and she crossed to the car and climbed inside reluctantly, taking in the rich, leathery smell of the seats. She had only ever been in a car a few times, as one wasn't necessary in the city. Her gaze marveled at its dashboard and around its mysterious dials and knobs.
Here we go.
Marco slid inside the driver's seat and closed the door. He started the engine, and the car began motoring through the narrow streets.
My boss loves cars, and this is one of three he owns. I'm in charge of getting them serviced and maintained. They say Il Duce favors the Alfa Romeo, and most of those sedans are used on official business. But this car is a gem. This is the only convertibile.
Does your boss know you have it?
He's out of town.
Marco beamed as he drove ahead. But Elisabetta felt self-conscious at being so visible, as she had never driven in a convertibile. It felt disrespectful on the day she had buried her father, and she hoped the neighbors didn't see.
Everyone's looking at us.
They're jealous. Marco shrugged.
No, they think you're in the government.
I am.
Marco glanced over, his expression soft.
You've had a hard time today, and you need a diversion. I'll get us onto the Lungo Tevere, and we can go fast.
I don't want to go fast.
Maybe you just don't know it yet.
Marco smiled, and the car picked up speed, turning onto the Lungo Tevere Sanzio. Her hands flew automatically to her hair, hoping to keep it in place. He joined the line of traffic, stopping at a red light, then turned to her.
It will get more fun now, and you'll love the feel of the wind.
We won't be able to hear ourselves talk.
That's true, but there are things you can't do when you're talking.
Marco leaned over, giving her a peck on the lips. Elisabetta shook her head at him.
I should have known.
But you didn't. You don't know everything, Cara. I know some things that you don't, and I'll show them to you. Wouldn't that be a wonderful way to live?
Elisabetta warmed. She hadn't expected to hear words of love in an open car, but Marco could be spontaneous that way. Life with him was a sort of adventure, and he lifted her spirits every time. The traffic light turned green and the car leapt forward. They were quickly out of Trastevere, and in no time she found herself enjoying the ride. The big engine rumbled as they traveled southward, and she gave up on her hair, letting it whip around her face in a crazy fashion. She realized that after a heartbreaking day, it felt good to empty her head and whiz past the lights and shadows of the beautiful buildings, ancient ruins, and imposing municipal offices. They zoomed out of the city, and she surrendered to Marco's plan, having none of her own except to survive the day on which she had buried her father. The buildings gave way to fields, and the odors changed from diesel fumes to fresh air and earthy manure, natural and good. She rested her head back on the cushioned leather seats and looked up at the night sky as they drove through the countryside, so that the environs were as dark as the sky and all around her was a soft blackness. The car raced into the night, and Elisabetta experienced the sensation that she and Marco were hurtling together through space and time. Tears came to her eyes. She thought of her father and wondered where he was right now. Perhaps on his way to heaven, as suspended as she in time and space. She wished she could see him just one more time. Marco slowed the car and pulled over to the side of the road. But Elisabetta didn't know why. She looked over, expecting to find him grinning, exhilarated from their adventure. Instead, she could see in the light from the dashboard that he looked crestfallen, and his large eyes glistened.
Marco, what's the matter?
I'm sorry, your father died. I can't imagine how sad you are, but I know you must be worried about so many things, especially money. Is that right?
Thank you, but I know what to do.
Elisabetta, you don't have to do this alone. I love you, and I will help you. I will give you any money you need, anything to make your life easier.
Elisabetta felt moved.
Marco, I don't need your money.
I wanted you to know that you never have to do anything alone, ever again. You are no longer alone as long as I live.
Elisabetta felt her heart respond, as the sentiment comforted her on the very day she felt more alone than ever. She leaned over and kissed him gently on the lips, and he kissed her back, more fully. And she felt lost in his kiss the way she always did with him, as his tenderness swept her away. In the next moment, he released her from his embrace, moving a strand of her hair back.
Now it's your turn.
Marco got out of the driver's seat, opened her car door, and gestured her out of the car.
Come on, get in the driver's seat.
Elisabetta recoiled.
Marco, are you crazy? I don't know how to drive.
It's easy. Idiots do it every day.
Not this idiot.
Look, this is the perfect place to learn.
Marco gestured at the country road, a dark line stretching into the night.
There's no other traffic, and all you have to do is go straight.
Marco, no.
Elisabetta, what did I tell you? You can do anything. Come on.
Marco hustled to the passenger side and opened the door, where, despite her objections, he lifted her bodily from the seat, marched her around to the driver's seat, and closed the door.
Marco, I can't drive.
Elisabetta put her hands on the steering wheel.
Yes, you can. I'll help you.
Marco vaulted inside into the passenger seat and landed with a little grunt. Then they both burst into laughter.
You're crazy.
You're not crazy enough.
Feel on the floor with your feet. There's a gas pedal on the right and a clutch pedal on the left.
Elisabetta fumbled for the pedals, then placed her feet on them.
Okay.
Brava. Now, press your right foot down to feed the car gas and press up with your left foot to engage the clutch.
At the same time?
Yes, but when I tell you,
Right foot down, left foot up. I'll do the rest.
What's the rest?
The gear shift. Don't worry about it.
Still, it sounds hard.
Only at first. You'll get the hang of it.
So do it now?
Yes, now.
Elisabetta pressed one foot down and the other up. The car lurched, bucked, then stopped. The engine screeching as if in agony.
Oh no, did I break it?
No, Marco chuckled. Try again. Ready? Now.
Elisabetta tried again, but it happened a second time, which left her shaken, if determined.
Again.
Okay, now.
Elisabetta tried again, and though the car stutter-stepped forward and the engine screeched, this time it didn't stop.
Oh, look. Did it work?
Keep going. Give it more gas.
Marco spoke louder to be heard over the engine.
No more clutch.
Not until I say.
Elisabetta gave the car gas, squeezed the wheel, and tried to steer straight. The car's headlights shone cones of light in the darkness, and she didn't dare to look left or right, focused on her driving. The car sped up, and the smooth sensation of motion made her smile. Then the engine whined at a higher pitch, like a cat with its tail stepped on.
Clutch again. Now.
Elisabetta didn't understand.
The clutch is already up.
Press down and up. Now.
Elisabetta did so, and it must have worked because the car jolted forward and they started to go faster.
I did it,
she yelled, excited.
More gas.
Where are we going?
Forward.
Is it safe?
Of course not.
Elisabetta laughed and gave the car more gas, then even more, pressing the clutch pedal when Marco cued her. They flew down the road, spraying gravel and dirt, and she felt thrilled by the sensation of speed and power at her command. She began to giggle, racing a big black convertible to a place she didn't know at all. She sensed that was her life now, in that she knew only what was behind her and had no idea what lay ahead. She gave the car more gas, feeling truly in charge, a free woman of Rome, and for all of that, she had Marco to thank. She raced along, the car shuddering beneath her. Was it possible she had fallen in love with both him and Sandro? And if so, how would she ever choose? Elisabetta kept driving into the future.
Chapter 33. Sandro. 5th September, 1938. Sandro slid his bicycle into the crowded rack in the schoolyard. It was the first day of school, and all of the students were outside standing in groups. Usually they'd be chattering, laughing, and fooling around, but they were quiet and seemed unusually subdued. Elisabetta was uppermost in his thoughts. He scanned the crowd for her, but she wasn't here yet. He spotted his classmates Carlo, Ezio, and Vittorio standing in a circle looking at a piece of paper and approached them. Ciao, he said, happy to see them. How were your summers? The three looked up from the sheet of paper, their expressions stunned, and none of them offered a response. What's the matter? Sandro asked, puzzled. Carlo frowned. The government passed some race laws, whatever that's supposed to be. Race laws? Sandro asked, puzzled. What does that mean? We don't understand. Ezio pursed his lips. It's horrible. It means that the Jews are kicked out of school. The Jewish teachers and the Jewish students both. Are you joking? Sandro didn't understand. It wasn't funny. No, it's not a joke. Presi di Livorno is going to speak about it any minute. They gave us all a notice, Here, take a look. Vittorio handed him a sheet of paper. The first part is about the teachers. Sandro accepted the paper, and its title was Measures for the Defense of Race in Fascist Schools. He read the first paragraph. Article 1. The position of teacher in state or state-controlled schools of any order or degree, and in the non-state schools of which the studies are legally recognized, cannot be granted to people of the Jewish race, even if they won the position through a competitive state examination prior to the present degree. Nor can they be granted positions as university assistants, nor can they obtain a university teaching qualification. Sandro looked up, stricken. There can't be Jewish teachers anymore? That's crazy. What happens to them? Carlo shook his head. We think they're fired. Ezio's face fell. Professoressa Longhi is crying. All the teachers are upset. None of us know what's going on or why. Oh, no. Sandro kept reading, horrified. Article 2. Students of the Jewish race cannot be enrolled in schools of any type or level of which the studies are legally recognized. Sandro gasped, incredulous. He read the sentence twice. If he hadn't seen it printed in black and white, he never would have believed it was possible. I don't understand. I'm already enrolled in school. Is this real? This is a law now? I'm not allowed to go? I think so, Carlo muttered. I don't know why they're doing this. It was never this way. It's wrong to single out the Jews for no reason. This can't be true. Sandro had a million thoughts at once. I'm Jewish, so I can't go to school anymore? What do I do? This is my school. I go here. I'm graduating this year. Does this mean I don't graduate? I'm kicked out of my own school? We don't know either, Vittorio frowned. I'm so sorry, Sandro. Maybe Presi di Livorno will explain. It doesn't make any sense to us. My God! Sandro couldn't believe it was happening. He wanted to go to La Sapienza for undergraduate and graduate degrees in mathematics. He wanted to learn all he could, then teach and publish papers. He wanted to contribute, like Professor Levi Civita. He had goals, but he couldn't achieve a single one if he couldn't graduate from high school. All of a sudden, he had no future at all. He glanced around in disbelief. His anguished gaze sought out the other Jewish students, though he had to pause before he remembered who was Jewish and who wasn't. It had simply never mattered to him or anyone else at school. He had no idea why it mattered now. He spotted Giulia and Carlotta, whom he knew from synagogue, and tears stained their cheeks as they read the sheet of paper. He returned his attention to the sheet, trying to collect his thoughts. Ezio and Carlo fell silent, and Sandro read Article 3, which said that Jewish teachers were suspended, and then Article 4, which stated, Article 4. Those members of scientific, literary, and artistic academies, institutes, and associations who are of the Jewish race will cease to be part of said institutions beginning on October 16, 1938. Sandro's mind reeled. Professor Levi Civita was Jewish. And if Jewish professors could no longer teach, that meant that the professor was suspended too. It was unthinkable. It was insane. Sandro was supposed to go to La Sapienza after school today. He didn't know if Professor Levi Civita or if any of the other Jewish professors would be there, or the Jewish students. Suddenly the students erupted in chatter, turning to face the entrance to the school, and Presi di Livorno appeared, with the faculty grouped behind him. His bright white hair blew in the breeze, and his gaze was solemn behind his glasses. He was stooped in his three-piece suit. All of the teachers were distraught, clinging to each other, and many had puffy eyes as if they'd been weeping. "Students," Preside Livorno motioned, "please, I need your attention." Sandro felt someone touching his arm. He looked over to see Elisabetta. Without a word, she took his hand, looking heartbroken for him. Preside Livorno gave the fascist salute, which everyone returned. Then he began to speak.
"Students, you have already received a copy of this new law, Regio Decreto number 1390. It is a royal decree. I am very sorry to say that according to this law, Jewish students are no longer permitted to attend school here. In addition, Jewish teachers are no longer permitted to teach here."
"Preside Livorno, this is wrong," Sandro called out, angering. "This law is wrong. You can't do this." Other students shouted, "This is unfair. Yes, this is wrong. Can they do that? Why are they doing this?
This is my school. You should refuse to do it, Preside Livorno. Please settle down."
Preside Livorno motioned for silence again.
"We were instructed to give no opinion regarding this law, so we will not. We were instructed to see to its enforcement, so we must. We have been informed that Jewish students will be permitted to form their own schools, which they may attend with other Jewish students."
Sandro called out again.
"You mean make our own schools? How do we do that, Preside Livorno? This is unjust."
Preside Livorno's lined face fell.
"Sandro, we were told there may be funding to the Jewish community in that regard. Again, we are very sorry."
"But how do I graduate?"
Sandro shot back. Other students chimed in to echo Sandro's concern. Preside Livorno's eyes filmed behind his glasses.
"My deepest apologies. I'm afraid I can say no more. I have no choice in this matter under this law."
The bell sounded, signaling that classes were to begin. But no one moved. Sandro froze, unsure whether to stay or go. It was his school, and he had been so excited about the school year. His final one before graduation, his time with Elisabetta. Preside Livorno called out,
"Students, come in, the school day must commence. To all of our Jewish students, we wish you the best of luck in your future endeavors. Everyone else, please enter the building with dispatch."
Sandro glanced over, as Carlo, Ezio, Vittorio, and his other classmates headed into the building. Elisabetta embraced him.
"Sandro, I'm so sorry. They can't do this, can they? I don't know."
Sandro released her.
"Go,"
he said softly.
"You have to go inside."
"No, I want to stay with you. Please,
go."
"I'm staying with you."
Elisabetta took his hand, but Sandro touched her shoulder, easing her off.
"Listen, I'll see you later."
The final bell rang, and Preside Livorno turned to the students.
"For those permitted, please come in. We were instructed to keep classes on schedule. We mustn't start later than necessary."
Sandro tried to absorb the shock.
"Really, go inside. I want to go to La Sapienza and see what's happening with the professor."
He kissed her on the cheek.
"I'll see you when I can."
"Of course."
Sandro watched Elisabetta turn reluctantly away, walk to the entrance with the other Gentile students, then glance back at him. He could see how much she was hurting for him. So he put on a brave face and waved goodbye. She climbed the steps into school amid the throng, and the schoolyard emptied of everyone except the Jewish students, Carlotta, Malca, Giulia, and others whose names he didn't know, Tyrion confused. The doors to the school closed, and Sandro stood in mute astonishment on the outside, among the other Jewish students. Noise and chatter emanated from the school's open windows, and he knew that everyone would be filing into the classrooms about to sing Giovinezza. He had sung it every day too, but today, fascism had excluded him from his school and everyone he knew, including the girl he loved.
"What do we do now?"
Julia approached, wiping her eyes.
"I don't know, but I have to go."
Sandro hurried for his bicycle. Sandro pedaled through the streets, faster than he ever had before. The morning rush hour was in full swing, and it was all he could do to stay out of the way of cars, trams, and other bicycles. Everyone was hurrying to get to work or school, oblivious to the upheaval in the lives of Rome's Jews. He reached La Sapienza in record time, steered onto the asphalt path that ran through the center of campus, and joined the other students riding bicycles and walking in groups. He passed the new administration building, a massive edifice that had been built under Mussolini, which Sandro was seeing with new eyes. Its monolithic design used to impress him, but today it intimidated him. He turned onto the path leading to the round, ultra-modern building that housed the mathematics department, and a large crowd of students buzzed on the grass in front. He jumped off his bike just in time to see a line of students, devastated and distraught, leaving the math building carrying their belongings. Sandro felt stricken, witnessing the scene with dismay. Next to him stood a heavyset student, who also looked upset, and Sandro turned to him.
"Excuse me, is this because of the new law?" "Yes. The Jewish students were thrown out this morning. The Jewish professors received letters of dismissal, so they're fired. The course schedule is chaos. Nobody knows what to do. It's shocking."
"What about Levi Civita? Has he left yet? Do you know?"
"Levi Civita? You have Levi Civita?"
The student's dark eyes lit up with new regard.
"I'm Franco Dutolo."
Sandro introduced himself, shaking his hand.
"Which course do you take with Levi Civita?"
"No course, an independent study."
"I haven't seen him yet, but I just got here. I'm on a waiting list for his seminar. Or I was. I transferred from the University of Padua. Levi Civita taught there for years. Everyone loved him. He takes the students on trips to the Alps."
Franco turned and eyed the scene, shaking his head.
"This is disgusting. It's bigotry. I never would have thought this could happen. And people are saying it will decimate the math department. Professors Volterra and Castelnuova already left. Believe it or not, some of the students were jeering."
Sandro recoiled, appalled.
"I heard that Professor Enriquez tried to get into the library, but they wouldn't let him."
Franco's eyes flared in outrage.
"They threw him out. One of the finest mathematicians of the century."
"This is terrible."
Sandro watched the graduate assistants walk by, some looking numb, many crying.
"Can you imagine? This is happening at universities all over the country. Padua, Bologna, Turin, Ferrara, Milan.
I have to go inside."
"Don't. They told us not to. They told us to wait outside."
But Sandro wasn't following the rules anymore. He rolled his bicycle to the entrance, made his way through the crowd, and hurried into the building, his heart in his throat. Chaos reigned in the noisy hallway, and students milled everywhere, chattering and crying. Staff hugged each other, and professors wiped away tears. Sandro took a right turn, heading for Professor Levi Civita's office, driven to see him one last time, to say goodbye,
and thank you. He threaded his way through the crowd in the hallway and spotted Enzo standing outside the professor's office.
Enzo!
Sandro hurried over, but the professor's door stood open, and his office was empty. Enzo's eyes glistened.
You just missed him. I'm so sorry. I knew you would come. I was hoping you would get here in time.
Sandro felt his throat thicken, and all of the emotions he had been suppressing caught up with him. He wanted to break down and cry, not only for himself, but for the professor and everyone else, too.
I'm so sorry about this law,
Enzo sniffled. Obviously, it disgusts me. It's discrimination, and it should be overturned, but I know that doesn't help you now. You are a brilliant student. I learned from you, not the other way around.
Thank you,
Sandro said, swallowing hard, as the kind words brought his sadness to the fore.
How was the professor? Was he upset? Yes, but he held his head high. This is a nightmare. We're losing everybody. Where did he go?
Sandro struggled to maintain his composure.
I don't know. Everybody's in an uproar. No one understands this new law.
Enzo rubbed his face.
The rumor is it's going to affect almost 100 professors across the country. It's so stupid and wrong, and it will only hurt Italy. We're going to lose the best. What's the sense in that?
Sandro didn't have any answers. He would have to leave La Sapienza right now, never to return. He would never get his chance to work for Levi Civita. He would never teach here or contribute to the field of mathematics.
Are you going to be okay?
Does it matter? Sandro answered matter-of-factly.
Chapter 34 Elisabetta, 5th of September, 1938. After school, Elisabetta entered the steamy kitchen at Casa Servano and hung up her purse outside the pantry, where Nonna sat at her table. Four chubby lines of soft dough sat dusted with flour, and the old woman's silvery head was bent over them as she cut one line into small sections, leaving a row of small pasta pillows. Elisabetta assumed Nonna was making gnocchi, but Paolo hadn't been at the bar to play the guessing game, and she was in no mood anyway. She had worried about Sandro all day, and school had been awful, with all the students, teachers, and administration upset and angry.
Ciao, nonna.
Elisabetta crossed to kiss Nonna on the cheeks, breathing in her familiar smells of flour and rose water.
Did you hear what happened today? To the Jews?
What do you think? I live in a cave. Mussolini turns on the Jews, bringing Trastevere to tears, throwing children out of their schools, teachers out of jobs. The man is a monster, a scourge. Now, you.
Nonna glanced up from her work, her mouth pursed tightly.
Sit down.
Me? And Mussolini?
Elisabetta sat down, bewildered.
Isn't that my newspaper?
Nonna gestured to yesterday's newspaper resting on the other chair.
Yes.
I'm angry with you.
Why?
Nonna pressed her index and middle finger into one of the soft pillows of pasta, made a dimple in the center, then sent it skidding across the floor with a deft backhand of her fingernails.
You wrote on my newspaper.
Elisabetta had circled some rooms to let.
I suppose so, yes. I'm sorry.
You're looking for a place to stay?
Yes.
You didn't think to ask me.
Nonna rolled another piece of pasta.
Don't you realize how insulted I am? Didn't you think I'd have a room for you? Don't you know I'm a woman of means, Don't you know I own property? I have a very nice room in one of my buildings. It even has a bathroom.
For me?
Of course for you.
Nonna scowled, exasperated. Elisabetta didn't understand. It sounded like an offer, if not for Nonna's manner.
Well, thank you, then. How much is the rent?
Nonna's head snapped up, her hooded eyes flaring behind her spectacles.
Elisabetta, what kind of woman do you think I am?
Elisabetta felt overwhelmed.
A room? For free? I can't possibly accept such generosity.
Then I'll fire you. Say goodbye to Casa Servano and me.
No,
Elisabetta rushed to say, confused.
You mean yes? What's the matter with you? Can't you say yes?
Yes,
Elisabetta answered, grateful to be prompted. It wasn't a conversation, it was a minefield.
Thank you. Where is the room?
Via Fiorata, 28.
Elisabetta blinked.
That's where you live, isn't it?
Yes, I told you, I own it. Don't you listen?
Nonna sent another gnocchi flying across the flower.
I am on the ground floor. You will be upstairs, with your very own bathroom.
Wonderful. Thank you.
Elisabetta felt relief wash over her like a warm bath. But Nonna was looking up at her fiercely, with a knife in her hand.
There is one problem. Your stupid cat.
How do you know about my cat?
Elisabetta swallowed hard. She would never put Rico on the street. She would rather give up the free room.
You don't know I see you collecting fish scraps. Or hear you talking about how smart he is, how handsome, how affectionate.
May I bring him?
Does he spray?
No.
Nonna eyed her, deciding.
Then yes.
Elisabetta hugged her, unable to hold back.
But if he sprays, said Nonna, I'll cut off his gnocchi.
Chapter 35. Sandro. 5th September, 1938.
Rosa!
Sandro looked up from his notebook, happy to see his older sister entering the apartment. She had moved into her own place with some roommates and didn't come home that often. She crossed into the dining room, setting down her purse and embraced him. She had on her fashionable tan suit with her hair pulled into its twist, and he caught a fading whiff of her floral perfume.
I heard what happened at school, Sandro. I'm so sorry.
Thanks. It happened at La Sapienza, too. Levi Civita left. I was too late to say goodbye.
Oh, no. You must be so sad.
I'm trying not to be. Sandro spoke from the heart. I'm trying to stay on track.
You can't stay on track when your own government is derailing you.
Rosa frowned sympathetically. Mussolini has turned against us. The manifesto and the race laws show he doesn't want Jews in Italy any longer. He's going to make life so hard for us that we leave.
But why, do you think? Why now, after all this time?
It's what David and I have been worried about. Mussolini is choosing to side with Hitler. And if Hitler is against the Jews, so is Mussolini.
Rosa touched his arm tenderly. I know you love Papa, and so do I. But he's missing what I see at the embassy.
Sandra felt torn. But he knows people in the party, and he reads the papers?
He reads only the fascist papers, and all of his closest friends are fascists. They go with Mussolini no matter what.
Rosa squeezed his arm. Anyway, just because Papa thinks something doesn't mean you have to. Fascism is now our enemy. Jews should leave the party after today. The race laws are the last straw.
They threw you out of school. It's outrageous.
Papa says it will be temporary. He's wrong, Sandro. You have to think for yourself. Rosa! His mother entered the room and kissed Rosa on both cheeks, followed by his father.
What a nice surprise!
His father held out his arms to embrace Rosa, but Sandro detected the effort in his parents' smiles. All evening, they had been talking privately in his father's study. Rosa kissed them both. What a terrible day. I'm horrified. As are we, his mother said, her tone controlled. But your father is already working on solutions. You'll stay and eat, won't you? Sandro interjected. It's my consolation dinner, Rosa. Cornelia promised me something fried. Rosa chuckled, a happy sound amid the tension. I'd love to stay. Good. Sit down, and I'll get another place setting. His mother turned and left for the kitchen.
Yes, sit down, both of you.
His father crossed to the table, picked up his wine glass, poured some, and offered it to Rosa.
How have you been?
Fine, until today. Rosa accepted the wine and sat down. Papa, what about the race laws? What is Mamma talking about, solutions?
We have to keep our wits and go forward. There is a provision for Jewish schools to be established with government funding.
But what do you think of the party now? You, of all people, who are so loyal, must have been shocked. It's an about-face, is it not?
As I told Sandro, I am shocked by the promulgation of the race laws. However, since then, I've had some time to study the law, confer with members of the board, and make some calls.
Rosa frowned. It's horrifying. Nothing can change that, Papa.
The board is already exploring renting a space in which to hold classes, and members of the community are volunteering to teach. We certainly have plenty of teachers and professionals who can help us.
But, Rosa started to say, but his father raised a hand.
Jewish teachers who were displaced today have been calling the synagogue looking for work, and we are making a list to see how many we can hire. I have suggested we take Professor Esalonghi, Sandro's math teacher. Sandro can help teach arithmetic to the younger students. He's always wanted to teach, so perhaps we can look on this as an opportunity.
An opportunity? Rosa repeated, her disapproval undisguised. His mother re-entered the room with the place setting, set a dish and silverware in front of Rosa, then sat down.
Yes, his father answered firmly. Obviously, this is a bad situation, but we must make the best of it. There's no reason for Sandro and the others to lose time, as they will still be eligible to take the state examination at the end of the year. If they pass, they will graduate.
So that's been provided for?
Yes. What matters most is that the academic needs of the students are met.
His father patted him on the shoulder.
Obviously, this is not a problem only for Sandro's liceo. There are early estimates that about 6,000 Jewish students are affected, 170 secondary school teachers, and 100 university professors. So we'll adapt.